Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 22nd, 2022 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows in the foreground we have British Prime Minister Boris flying at us. He is being tossed by two British policemen, and they are standing in front of the famous residence of the Prime Minister, number 10 Downing Street, I believe it is. The headline is, Why Boris Was Bounced. After 3 years of lies, scandals, and sophistry, the UK looks for new leadership. And I think that's one of our main stories, but we will start with the first one. Trump lit fuse on January 6th, says subcommittee. What happened? The January 6th Capitol insurrection was not a spontaneous uprising, but a planned attack spearheaded by Donald Trump in a last-ditch effort to overturn his election loss, members of the January 6th panel said. New evidence showed this week. The committee's seventh hearing zeroed in on how Trump's notorious December 19th tweet, summoning followers to a big protest in Washington on January 6th, "Be there, will be wild," galvanized far-right extremists, including the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, whose numbers grew as Trump's message was amplified by right-wing media figures. Trump planned all along to send his followers to the Capitol, but kept the scheme quiet, panel members said. "He is just going to call for it unexpectedly," wrote an organizer of the January 6th Save America rally in a text. Stephen Ayers, a Trump follower from Ohio, testified that it was Trump's tweet that brought him and others to Washington on January 6th and Trump's speech that sent him to break into the Capitol. "He got everybody riled up, told everybody to head on down, so we basically were just following what he said," Ayers said. Witnesses described a six-hour unhinged showdown in the Oval Office marked by yelling, threats, and a near fistfight on the night of December 18. On one side were a group of rabid outside advisors, including lawyer Sidney Powell and retired General Michael Flynn, who promoted wild conspiracy theories about Venezuela rigging voting machines and pushed Trump to direct the military to seize the machines. On the other were alarmed Trump aides, including White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who warned Trump of the legal and political consequences of staging a coup. Trump was ultimately talked out of seizing the machines, but shortly afterward sent out his tweet calling followers to the Capitol. What the editorial said. "Clearly, Trump's corrupt plot to remain in office ran frighteningly deep," said the Chicago Sun-Times. "Trump's clarion tweet sent right-wing media and militia leaders into frenzied action, formulating schemes to descend on Washington to prevent a peaceful transfer of power. Given the ties between those groups and Trump's close advisors Michael Flynn and Roger Stone, it's unlikely that Trump was ignorant of their dangerous plans. He must be held fully accountable." Despite Trump's public claims of a rigged election, the evidence shows he knew better, said the Washington Post. "His lawyers and closest advisors have testified that they told him repeatedly that there was no evidence of voter fraud. But perhaps the most consequential moment of the hearing came at the end, when Representative Liz Cheney revealed that Trump had recently called an unnamed witness in the committee investigation who reported it. This troubling outreach to a witness calls for further probing." What the columnist said. "The panel isn't conducting an investigation. It's presenting a political narrative, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review. Despite the media's hype, Americans are tuning out because they know the patently political Democrat-dominated committee is trying to shift the spotlight away from the train wreck that is the Biden presidency as the midterms loom. Trump did it, all of it, said Charles Sykes in the Bulwark. The committee has shown in excruciating detail that it was Trump who sought out clowns like Flynn and Powell to tell him what he wanted to hear, who lied to his followers about voter fraud, who leaned on DOJ to rustle up a sham investigation. It was Trump who rallied the mob on January 6th and who pointed them at the Capitol and told them to fight or lose their country. True, but let's not overlook House and Senate Republicans' complicity, said Greg Sargent and Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. After Trump gave his deluded followers the deranged hope that they could reverse the election, the vast bulk of mainstream Republicans went along with this doomed crusade, refusing to say that the election was over. Even after the assault on the Capitol, 140 House Republicans voted to object to Biden's election. Without a full accounting of that extraordinarily degenerate conduct, no investigation into this horror will be complete. And a second shorter main story, referring back to our cover drawing. Boris Johnson reluctantly steps down. What happened? Members of Britain's Conservative Party began jockeying to replace Boris Johnson this week after forcing him to resign as Prime Minister. Johnson, 58, spent weeks fighting to keep his job, but finally agreed to step down after dozens of government officials quit in protest. Their revolt followed a relentless series of scandals, most recently Johnson's claim that he forgot that a lawmaker he appointed to a government role had been accused multiple times of groping other men. The beleaguered prime minister narrowly survived a no-confidence vote last month over Partygate, the revelation that he had attended alcohol-fueled parties at his Downing Street headquarters during last year's strict COVID lockdowns. But his poll numbers were low. The herd instinct is powerful, Johnson said in a self-pitying resignation speech. When the herd moves, it moves. The country will not hold early elections. Instead, conservative lawmakers will vote in rounds for a new party leader. After they whittle the finalists down to two, likely by next week, the 160,000 dues-paying party members will vote for their next party leader, who will automatically become prime minister. That's how Johnson became prime minister in 2019, though he soon won a general election in a landslide. In the mix to replace him are former Treasury Chief Rishi Sunak, a wealthy ex-banker whose resignation last week spurred the mutiny, and several top conservative women, including Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. What the columnist said. Johnson was the embodiment of the Monty Python ideal of the upper class twit, said David Rothkopf in the Daily Beast. But neither Democrats nor Republicans should laugh at his downfall. President Biden's supporters should be alarmed to see a counterpart undone by inflation, supply chain failures, and other forces largely beyond the control of a national leader. Nor should Trumpists be happy to watch a once hugely popular nationalist and chronic liar abruptly kicked to the curb. Like Trump, Johnson was an entertainer playing politician, said Matt Potter in the Washington Post. He pursued whatever seemed to garner the most applause. Sometimes that worked out, like his unequivocal support for Ukraine, and sometimes it didn't, like his premature abandonment of COVID precautions, which gave Britain one of the world's worst COVID death rates. When he campaigned for Brexit, Johnson promised to make the UK great again, said Fred Kaplan in Slate. But cut out of the EU, Britain lost the opportunity to lead Europe's response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which could have made the EU something close to Washington's equal. Instead, the Ukraine war has demonstrated yet again that the U.S. remains the West's indispensable power. Johnson's rhetoric about Britain's renewed global leadership now reads like a sad joke. He leaves Downing Street with Britain reduced to just another U.S. sidekick. Controversy of the week. Abortion, a new war between the states? The old right-wing talking point that overturning Roe v. Wade would merely return the issue to the states had such a soothing ring of finality to it, said Greg Sargent in the Washington Post. But it never accounted for the reality that without Roe in place to protect women's rights, red and blue states would essentially be at war with one another. President Biden last week signed an executive order to protect access to reproductive health care services, and some of its provisions give troubling previews of the big red versus blue battles ahead. Most notably, Biden's order instructs the Attorney General to set up legal teams to offer pro bono defense work for both women and doctors if red states pursue women seeking abortions across state lines, which may become common in our brave new post-Roe world. Biden and the Democrats can't do much of anything to reverse the Supreme Court's ruling, said National Review in an editorial, and this nebulous executive order proves it. It is just an angry shout of surrender from a president out of options now that the states are free, as they always should have been, to craft their own laws on abortion. Biden can and should do much more, said Ellie Mistel in The Nation. If he were serious about defending women, he could fund travel vouchers for people who need to flee their Christo-fascist states in order to exert control over their own bodies, or even start leasing federal lands to abortion providers so they could open clinics within red states. The White House has already ruled the latter option out, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. They say red states might arrest women and doctors the moment they left the federal lands. But putting up clinics and daring red state prosecutors to do something about it is exactly the kind of high-profile fight that could galvanize voters into turning out for Democrats in November's midterms. The legal fight for reproductive rights is far from over at the state level, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. Many states have multiple abortion laws on the books, and officials have made conflicting statements about which law is in effect and what the penalties would be. In Kentucky and Idaho, there are promising cases arguing that privacy rights are guaranteed by state constitutions and thus still confer a right to abortion. These are uphill battles, but they're worth fighting. If conservative justices thought that by overturning Roe they'd wash their hands of abortion, said Harry Lipman in the New York Times, they were deluded. The ruling has accelerated the race among conservative state legislatures to pass draconian abortion restrictions, including laws against crossing state lines for abortions and assisting women to do so. This will mean lawsuits, lots of them, each touching on fundamental questions. Can Texas sue or punish doctors in other states for performing an abortion on a Texas resident? Can states block pregnant women from traveling to get an abortion? Can states completely ban abortion medications approved by the federal government or interdict federal mail containing abortion pills? Instead of de-escalating the abortion debate, said Jacob Bogage and Christopher Rowland in the Washington Post, the end of Roe has opened up a legal and cultural chasm between the states not seen since the era of slavery. We know where that conflict led. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for drunks. After the city council of Kalamazoo, Michigan, decriminalized public urination. It's kind of crude, explained city attorney Clyde Robinson, but we are a college town, and students filled with beer often can't seem to find a restroom. It was a good week for awakenings. After Marta Kaufman, co-creator of the sitcom Friends, issued a public apology for a 2001 episode which repeatedly misgendered a trans woman character. Pronouns were not yet something that I understood, Kaufman said. It was a good week for hunting for aliens after NASA announced that the new James Webb Space Telescope had clearly detected water vapor in the atmosphere of an exoplanet 1,150 light-years away. This is just the beginning, said astrophysicist Nicole Colon. But it was a bad week for colorful ethnic analogies. After First Lady Jill Biden had to apologize for praising Latino Americans during a speech in Texas for being as unique as the breakfast tacos here in San Antonio. It was a bad week for Brad Parscale, a former Trump campaign aide who, in a January 6th text that was made public this week, described Trump as a sitting president calling for civil war and blamed him for getting people killed. Parscale is working for Trump again, pocketing $150,000. It was a bad week for heightism after a flight attendant mistook a 4'8" Olympic gold-winning gymnast Simone Biles for a child and offered her a coloring book. I said, no, I'm good. I'm 25, Biles said. She responded. The other flight attendant gave me a mimosa. So we're in the clear. Here's a short and other news piece. A new COVID vaccine option. The Biden administration purchased 3.2 million doses of Novavax's COVID vaccine this week, anticipating approval of a fourth vaccine option in the U.S. that the Maryland-based company hopes will appeal to Americans who've resisted getting immunized. The Food and Drug Administration was expected to approve Novavax's two-shot regimen for primary immunization, but it may also be used for booster shots. The vaccine relies on an older protein-based vaccine technology used for decades. In contrast to Pfizer's and Moderna's innovative mRNA-based COVID vaccines. Novavax was awarded $1.6 billion as part of Operation Warp Speed, but has been repeatedly set back by production delays. Briefing this week is titled Against the Tide. In most of the world, abortion access has been rapidly expanding for decades. Where is abortion legal? In the 49 years since the landmark Roe v. Wade abortion case in 1973, much of the modern world has dramatically expanded access to abortion procedures. By overturning Roe, the U.S. became just one of four countries to roll back abortion rights since 1994, joining El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Poland, all heavily Roman Catholic countries. In the same time period, nearly 60 countries have liberalized their abortion laws, ranging from Ireland, which legalized abortion by a public referendum in 2018, to Mexico, Colombia, and Argentina. In the few countries that have rolled back abortion rights, access has become severely limited, and women report being surveilled and patrolled if they become pregnant or have miscarriages. Being pregnant means that police can come to you any time, said Polish activist Marta Limpart, and prosecutors can come to you to ask you questions about your pregnancy. When did abortion become commonplace? Women have terminated their pregnancies using various methods since ancient times. In many societies, the practice of abortion was tolerated, including by Puritans who first colonized North America. But a backlash arose in the English-speaking world during the 19th century due to concerns over unsafe practices such as swallowing forms of poison and male doctors' discomfort with the women's rights movement. In 1869, Pope Pius IX declared an embryo was a human being with a soul, challenging the long-standing belief that a fetus was not a person until it began moving in the womb, the quickening. Leftist European political movements, such as Republicans in Spain's Catalonia region, attempted to legalize abortion in the 1930s, but as a result, the procedure became associated with socialism and women's equality in the U.S., a significant obstacle that took abortion rights campaigners decades to overcome. How do Europe's laws compare? The differences between U.S. and European abortion laws are complicated, especially in practice. Last year, Chief Justice John Roberts said Mississippi's ban on abortions after 15 weeks, or roughly the first trimester of pregnancy, was the standard around the world. But while many European countries do indeed have restrictions limiting abortions from 12 to 21 weeks, they also offer broad exceptions for reasons such as the mother's age, health, or socioeconomic status. And in practice, doctors easily grant them. About 95% of European women of reproductive age live in countries where abortion is legal for a broad list of reasons. And the Guttmacher Institute estimates there are 73 million abortions every year throughout the world. Europe is also home to far more abortion clinics than the U.S., and in most countries, the procedure is covered by universal health care and is free. Earlier this year, France expanded the legal limit for abortion from 12 to 14 weeks, while Spain passed a law criminalizing the harassment of women seeking abortions. After the U.S. overturned Roe, the European Union's Parliament condemned the ruling in a 324 to 155 vote and called for reproductive freedom and the human rights of women and girls to be enshrined in the EU's charter. How did the U.S. and Europe diverge? The U.S. and Europe have several factors in common, including large, socially conservative Christian populations and robust anti-abortion movements. But in many European states and other countries around the world, abortion is protected by law rather than by court decision, making the protections less susceptible to lawsuits and the political makeup of courts. European countries from Ireland to Germany have passed legislation enshrining basic abortion protections. So have such countries as Uruguay, South Africa, and Thailand. In Mexico and Colombia, on the other hand, it was the courts that overturned previous abortion bans, and national legislatures have yet to pass laws legalizing the procedure. In Canada, the Supreme Court struck down an abortion ban in 1988, but no law has been passed. The court didn't really establish an abortion right, said Bernard Dickens, a professor emeritus of health law and policy at the University of Toronto. It simply took away the criminal penalty. Will Roe's demise affect other countries? Experts doubt that Roe will reverse the global trend toward expanding abortion access, but it could weaken localized movements dependent on U.S. support. In Africa, U.S. organizations have long provided access to contraceptives and promoted abortion rights. But when the Trump administration adopted a stringent global gag rule in 2017, cutting funding to any organizations that promote abortion, it shut down contraceptive services in Malawi, Senegal, and Kenya. Now, however, many U.S. neighbors are offering their services to American women who want abortions. Canadian clinics are bracing for an influx of women crossing the border, while in Mexico, the network Necesito Abortar Mexico says it has received a flood of inquiries from women in the U.S. We are here, They are not alone, said Sandra Cardona, a member of the network. There should be no women without rights, which is what they are trying to do in the United States. And we'll flip right over and start in on the best columns of the week. First up, Biden's Saudi sellout. A cynic is rarely disappointed by the actions of his fellow human beings, said Peter Bergen. President Biden's trip this week to make amends with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman will amuse cynics because it is so entirely predictable. Biden came into office vowing to make the kingdom a pariah for its 2018 murder of U.S.-based Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and its many other human rights abuses, including mass arrests and executions of political opponents. But now high gas prices are contributing to inflation, angering Americans, and hurting Biden politically. So Biden will go to Riyadh and meet with MBS and nicely ask him to produce more oil. This gives Prince Mohammed a chance to cleanse his image by posing alongside America's president. To be sure, Biden is not embracing the crown prince in the same obsequious manner that former President Donald Trump did. But after claiming that human rights would be centerpiece of his foreign policy, Biden is making the same cynical calculation as every president since Franklin Roosevelt. As long as the U.S. economy remains deeply tethered to hydrocarbons, and as long as the Saudis sit on an ocean of oil, this calculus will surely continue. Inventing a major legal doctrine. When can a federal agency enforce regulatory laws passed by Congress? Only when the conservative justices of the Supreme Court decide it can, said law professor David Super. That was the chilling warning in the West Virginia versus EPA decision 2 weeks ago, when the court ruled 6-3 that the federal agency cannot rely on the Clean Air Act to broadly regulate greenhouse gas emissions from energy plants. The ruling goes far beyond dramatically limiting the federal government's ability to address climate change. It challenges the government's authority to enforce any regulations. The court conceded that the Clean Air Act authorized the EPA to select the best system of emission reduction for power plants. But the court threw textualism in the trash and ruled that since phasing out coal-generated power plants would have a major impact, Congress had to pass new legislation explicitly enabling the EPA to do so. Under this major questions doctrine, every attempt to regulate industry can lead to years of litigation, with the court's judicial activists then making national policy. What happened to the idea that justices should leave policymaking to the political branches? This column comes from China. Heaven for the tourists, hell for nomads. China's regime drew kudos last year when it proudly announced the establishment of 5 new national parks, said Dixin Palmo. It said the parks would protect threatened species, but there's a terrible cost. One park, Sanjingyeon, lies in the northeastern edge of Tibetan Plateau. Nearly 14 times the size of America's Yellowstone, it encompasses lands renowned for their otherworldly beauty, lands where indigenous nomads have been grazing their livestock for thousands of years. Those nomads, known in Tibetan as Drokpa, or people of the high pasture, have now been evicted. Beijing claims that was necessary because their cattle were denuding the grasslands and causing desertification. Ecologists, though, argue that the nomads' relocation is just another example of colonial conservation, in which indigenous people are removed from their ancestral homes so the land can be left undisturbed. The nomads' seasonal pastoralism, they say, is actually vital to the grasslands' health. China's true motive is darker, to force the Tibetans into concrete villages so that their political activities can be monitored. The expansion of parkland and protection of wildlife is a mere excuse for a political project to squash Tibetan ethnic identity. And it's time for the last word, our in-depth article title this week, Warrior for a Trumpist Future. A former non-voter is now working ceaselessly to defeat those she sees as America's enemies within. She'll do whatever it takes, said Stephanie McCrummon in the Washington Post. 6 years into the grassroots movement unleashed by Donald Trump in his first presidential campaign, Angela Rubino is a case study in what that movement is becoming. Suspicious of almost everything, trusting of almost nothing, believing in almost no one other than those who share her unease, she has in many ways become a citizen of a parallel America. Not just red America, but another America entirely, one she believes to be awash in domestic enemies, stolen elections, immigrant invaders, sexual predators, the machinations of a global elite, and other fresh nightmares revealed by the minute on her social media scrolls. She is known online as Burn It Down. She is also among the people across the country willing to do whatever they can to ensure that the imagined enemies of the United States are defeated in the 2022 midterm elections and beyond. From school boards to state houses to Congress, their goal is to take political territory. For evidence that this is possible, they look to Northwest Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, whose first-time candidacy 2 years ago defined the fringe of the Republican Party, yet who is now running for re-election as one of its standard bearers. Green's followers include Rubino, a married 40-year-old mother of two, a New York transplant who had worked in restaurants and flipped houses for a living and once believed politics was only for the powerful. In Green, she did not see what much of America saw, a person willing to do almost anything to keep emotions running high, whether that meant perpetuating lies about election fraud, harassing a victim of a school shooting, speaking at a white nationalist conference, or casting fellow citizens who disagree with her as domestic terrorists. Instead, Rubino saw a person like herself, a political outsider who shared the same sense of urgency and the same dystopian America, one that required a popular uprising to save it. To that end, Rubino had so far managed to rally enough people to get the county election board ousted, replacing its members with those who believed that the 2020 election was stolen. She was part of a group called the Domestically Terrorized Moms that was pressing the local school board to get rid of a curriculum they believed was grooming children for sexual predators. She even fished through a dumpster outside the election board office to retrieve two bags of shredded documents she suspected could be evidence of voter fraud, though she had yet to piece the papers back together. She hadn't had time. Rubino had Republican Party meetings to attend where she was calling out rhinos, Republicans in name only. She had school issues to address, such as removing library books she deemed pornographic. And with Georgia's primary elections coming up, she had candidates she was trying to help. Now, on a cool Saturday morning, she was getting ready to host a gathering of fellow activists to strategize about their next moves. In her front yard, she pounded in two red signs for Green, along with a homemade sign announcing her own initiative. Canvas your vote here, it read, under a red, white, and blue circle with the letters W-A-R. She set out coffee and donuts in the bed of a pickup. She hooked up a loudspeaker she'd bought for the occasion. She built a roaring bonfire, and now Smoke and Aerosmith were drifting into the blue spring sky. "Yes, we'll be here," she yelled into her cell phone. "Come on out." Some were already assembled, including a military contractor who said he'd been reading a Russian book about CIA-sponsored regime change operations, which he believed included the last U.S. presidential election. There were women who were sure public schools were indoctrinating children with left-wing ideology, retirees who believed the coronavirus was a bioweapon, a mechanic who wore earbuds all day streaming War Room, the podcast of former Trump strategist Steve Bannon, who urged people to take over local Republican parties. Rubino's closest collaborator, a woman known online as The Base Is Back, was also there, setting out a display of custom gun components engraved with Trump and the American flag. She and Rubino began outlining their plans for the coming months, including building an online platform where people could record how they had voted. They had already acquired and uploaded to the platform the voter registration rolls for the entire state of Georgia, and they hoped millions of people would eventually use the system to generate a tally that could be compared with the state's official results, and if necessary, challenge them. To keep people motivated, they were launching an elaborate online game in which players would earn points by carrying out political actions in real life. The more audacious, the better. Such as Rubino's dumpster dive. "Angela's a legend," someone said at the mention of that, and Rubino rolled her eyes. "Everybody's waiting for a white horse to come and save us from the chaos," Rubino said. "But no white horse is coming." That's why Rubino kept doing the work. Ahead of the primary, she and her friend Melissa Smith loaded up her car with campaign signs and headed out into the district. "Did you hear about Kemp?" Smith said as they pulled onto a two-lane, referring to Republican Georgia Governor Brian Kemp's support of an electric car factory. "Yes," said Rubino, "but this stuff has been going on forever. It's just that now it's being revealed." "It's like they're all in it together," said Smith. "It's like they hate us all the same." It was a sunny day, and as they drove through a landscape of fresh green fields and wild flowers, they talked about all the ways they felt hated by Americans who weren't them. Rubino felt hated for thinking for myself. Smith felt hated for going against the narrative. Green was always saying it at her rallies. "They hate me, and they hate you." They reached the next town, pulling over at a busy intersection of fast food restaurants, payday lenders, and rundown gas stations, where they pounded signs into a grass median, one for an attorney general candidate pledging to prosecute officials who upheld the 2020 election, and one for a candidate trying to unseat a state senator who affirmed Biden's victory. They kept going, staking signs into weedy islands, strewn with beer cans and cigarette butts, patches of grass in front of old strip malls, and a triangle of dirt by a gun and pawn shop. "I don't want all those billions going to Ukraine when people are hurting here," said Smith. "I mean, what about opioids? Everyone around here knows somebody dealing with it. They should just let Russia handle Ukraine. They're ruled by Biden's family anyway." They passed more rolling farms and cattle billboards about Jesus. Discussing elites they'd read about on social media, who seemed to them ever more strange and remote from the life they knew. The billionaire Elon Musk and his brain chip company Neuralink. "Can you please stop trying to chip me?" Smith said. The billionaire Bill Gates and his world vaccination campaigns. The Hollywood actors with their esoteric habits. "Did you ever see that clip about Hillary Clinton where she cut a girl's face off and she wore it?" said Rubino, referring to one of the fake videos of the type always coming across her social media scroll. "I could hardly watch." "We have a problem as a society, clearly," said Smith. "And we're the weirdos," said Rubino. She was so busy that she barely had time to keep up with all the updates on her social media scrolls, which came in by the dozens every hour. Rhinos and Democrats just stole future elections in deep red Alaska, read one. It's war, read another. It's raging on all fronts. You have been used by all sides in the greatest psyops operation ever. The battle is only beginning, read one from Green. The communists came after me, but they were really coming after you. She read them all, and then, on a Sunday, when she was supposed to go to a rally for Green, she did something else instead. She turned off her phone. She did this sometimes whenever she was feeling overwhelmed by what she believed the country was becoming. Sometimes I'd like to know what the point is, she said. It was a question that had troubled her since the first time she ever asked it, when she was 8 years old in her mother's car on the way to religion class. The thought just came into my head, she said. I was thinking, what are we doing this for? What are we doing any of this for if we're just going to die? You die and it's over, so what's the point? She had never stopped thinking about it, and in some ways, she said, it was the question that had drawn her into the movement for Donald Trump. He was the first politician to give voice to her private thoughts about what America was becoming, which made her feel recognized and even important. She had never voted before, never felt herself mattering as a citizen, until Trump came on the scene along with everything else, the rallies, the social media, and eventually, successors such as Green. They were the ones who introduced her to the version of America she now inhabited. But what was happening, she realized, was that the more she believed in it, the more all the certainties of the old America were turning into suspicions. She no longer trusted her schooling. She no longer trusted traditional news. She no longer trusted election results. She no longer trusted courts or local government or state government or the U.S. government or any of the institutions of democracy she once took for granted. She was no longer sure America was the country she once thought it was. It's just endless questions, she said. You'd like to have somebody to trust, something to be sure of. At least Green was inspiring. At the victory celebration in May, after Green won her primary in a landslide, Rubino was feeling ever more significant, as Green's unfolding success felt in so many ways like her own. She shook hands, she hugged people, she took photos. She paused to give an interview for a podcast called Cowboy Logic, whose host asked about her work. It takes a lot of time, but for Marjorie, that's what you do, said Rubino. Green's speech described an America that Rubino believed in more and more, one at war with globalists and the democratic communist agenda, and elites who look down on us and hate us. The establishment GOP is falling in line. They will, and they want to, Green continued. And in the back of the room, a woman who climbed into a dumpster to save America knew that this was true. And they have, Rubino said. A version of this story originally appeared in the Washington Post. Read one of the obituaries this week. The actor who radiated macho charisma, James Caan, 1940 to 2022. James Caan could be a human powder keg on screen. He had varied roles in more than 130 films and TV shows over six decades, but remains best remembered for playing Sonny Corleone, Mob Don Vito Corleone's volatile, womanizing oldest son in The Godfather. Still, even for someone who was nicknamed Killer Caan as a boy growing up in Queens, the tough guy persona didn't always come easily. Sonny's gruesome killing by a half-dozen machine-gun-wielding hitmen at a toll booth required Caan to wear 147 miniature explosive devices. When they went off, it felt like I was being punched all over, he admitted in a 1999 interview. I wouldn't have done it if there hadn't been so many girls around the set to impress. The son of German-Jewish immigrants, Khan dropped out of several schools but graduated at 16, said the New York Times. He studied acting at Manhattan's prestigious Neighborhood Playhouse and won small parts in TV and film before Francis Ford Coppola cast him as a mentally challenged ex-football player in 1969's The Rain People, earning him critical praise. The 1971 TV movie Brian's Song, in which he played dying Chicago Bear Brian Piccola, still ranks as one of the top guy cry movies of all time. Coppola's next project, The Godfather, turned Khan into an A-list star, and his rugged good looks and obvious smarts shone through his performances. But the actor who unwisely turned down parts in Kramer vs. Kramer and Apocalypse Now also gained a reputation for being difficult, said the Daily Telegraph. When his sister died of leukemia in 1981, he embarked on an orgy of self-destruction that included multiple failed marriages, deep financial woes, and a cocaine addiction. Khan had become all but unemployable by the time Coppola cast him in 1987's Gardens of Stone, said the Washington Post. The Vietnam War drama received middling reviews but could put Khan on the comeback trail. He scored a triumph acting mostly from a bed in the 1990 adaptation of Stephen King's novel Misery and grew to become a respected character actor, though he still lapped up attention from Godfather fans. They'll say, hey, don't go through that toll booth again or have the right change, he said in 2004. It means they never remember the picture. Oh, it means they remember the picture. I hope they never stop. And we'll flip on over to the Talking Points page. First article is Griner. Only a prisoner swap can save her. Brittany Griner is living an international nightmare, said Bill Plaschke in the Los Angeles Times. The WNBA All-Star and two-time Olympic gold medalist has languished in a Moscow area prison since mid-February, after customs officials found vape cartridges containing 0.7 grams of cannabis oil in her luggage while she was en route to play for a Russian pro basketball team. Facing a court system with a 99% conviction rate, Griner pleaded guilty last week. The Russians evidently hoped the power of celebrity would make her a valuable pawn to trade. But so far, the U.S. has made no offer. In a new letter to President Biden, Griner pleaded, please don't forget about me. But without a prisoner swap with Russia, 10 years in the hell of a Russian penal colony await her. Complications abound in this awful affair, said Kurt Streeter in the New York Times. Griner's status as a 6'9" black gay woman caught in the clutches of an openly homophobic regime heightens fears for her well-being. But she is not the only American detained in Russia. Former Marine Paul Whelan is serving a 16-year sentence on trumped-up espionage charges. Is it fair to push for Griner's release before Whelan's? The Kremlin thinks it can win this sick game, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. State TV pundits have even floated trading Griner for arms dealer Victor Bout, who was convicted in 2011 for selling weapons to Colombian terrorists to be used against American military advisors. But the U.S. does not negotiate with terrorists and shouldn't exchange either American for a man nicknamed the Merchant of Death unless we want to encourage hostile regimes to target other U.S. citizens. When I was a war correspondent, I saw the unspeakable atrocities Bout enabled, said Douglas Farah in Politico. His smuggled arms reached the worst sectors of humanity, the Taliban, Muammar Gaddafi, and West African warlords who forced child soldiers to kill their own families. Still, Biden should take the deal if it's offered. Bout will be out of jail in a few years anyway, and is a spent force. Trading the merchant of death for a basketball player will disappoint anyone seeking perfect justice, but it's better than ensuring Griner remains wrongfully imprisoned in Russia for a decade. Election law, a grave new threat to democracy. The Supreme Court just agreed to hear a case that poses the gravest threat to American democracy since the January 6 attack, said Ian Millhiser in Vox. As the court recently closed out its tumultuous term, it announced that next session it will take up Moore versus Harper, which could give partisan state legislatures total, unchecked power over elections. The case is about North Carolina's highest court invalidating the GOP-controlled state legislature's gerrymandered congressional map. The redistricting, the state court ruled, gave Republicans extreme partisan advantage in violation of the state constitution. Republicans sued to reinstate the map, basing their argument on a right-wing legal theory known as the independent state legislature doctrine. This theory holds that the Constitution gives state legislatures sole power to set election laws, with governors and state courts cut out of the process entirely. Were the high court to endorse that theory, state legislatures could legally do what Donald Trump sought to do in 2020, toss out millions of election ballots for arbitrary reasons and declare the loser of a presidential election the winner. The implications for 2024 are dire, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. With the doctrine in effect, the next time Trump or other Republicans try to overturn a lost election, they won't need a mob. Currently, 30 state legislatures are held by the GOP, including in most of the battleground states that determine presidential election outcomes, said legal analyst Lawrence Tribe and Dennis Aftergut in the Los Angeles Times. If conservative justices embrace this theory, they will create a bogus legal justification for one-party rule, and Americans will lose our freedom to govern ourselves. The fact that this precedent-shattering court would even consider this unsupported fringe theory is deeply alarming, said Thomas Wolfe and Ethan Herrenstein in The Atlantic. In a 2020 election case, Justices Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch expressed support for the radical theory, and Alito said its legality was a recurring question the court needed to resolve. But giving total, unchallenged control over elections to state legislatures would define the plain meaning of the Constitution's text, a century of precedent and common sense. It would blow up election law and create electoral chaos across the nation. And yet, to solidify Republican rule, these justices might do it anyway. And we'll finish up with some shorter notes, starting with bottlenose dolphins are appearing in the waters off New York City, which are cleaner than they have been since the Civil War. Schools spent an estimated $3.1 billion on security equipment and services last year. More than 90% of schools now have security cameras, and there is a brisk market in alarm systems, fortified doors, centrally controlled locking systems, and gunshot alarms. The amount of U.S. electricity generated by wind, solar, and hydroelectric dams hit a record high of 28% in April as the cost of renewable energy continues to plunge. It's a milestone, said energy analyst Peter Kelly Detweiler. COVID was the leading cause of death among Americans ages 45 to 54 in 20 and 2021, and the third leading cause of death overall. More than 1 million gun sales were completed in 2020 and 2021 before background checks on the buyers were concluded, A recent FBI report reveals, if a background check takes longer than 3 business days, sellers are allowed to complete the sale while the investigation is still pending. The overwhelmed FBI never finished 734,000 of these checks, and of the ones they did complete, 11,564 turned up criminal or mental health records. On the poll watch, 49% of Americans say indoor masking is extremely or very effective in limiting the spread of COVID, compared with 23% who say it's somewhat effective and 28% who say it's either not very effective or not at all effective. 55% of Americans believe vaccines are extremely or very effective, including 75% of Democrats and 32% of Republicans. Just 41% of Americans say the coronavirus is a major public health threat, the lowest level of concern since March 2020. And we will finish out with a quote from George Eliot, quoted in Forbes, who says, "A difference of taste in jokes is a great strain upon the affections." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.